From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Republican lawmakers are already working on their top priority for the new session, getting rid of Obamacare.
Russian President Vladimir Putin vowing today to stay neck and neck with the U.S. if President-elect Donald Trump does seek to expand the U.S. nuclear arsenal after taking office.
We've learned more about who will be attending the Trump inauguration. The list includes former President George W. Bush and his wife, Laura, as well as Bill and Hillary Clinton.
This all came about after House Republicans initially voted late last night to weaken an independent body that investigates ethics complaints against House lawmakers.
That's a bit of the week's news, a little bit out of context here on The Wheelhouse. And we're going to start today, though, at the state level with our guests, Ben Duvall, former Republican strategist, owner of Dromana Strategies. He's communications and public policy consultant. And Ben, good to see you once again.
Good morning.
He's sitting in today for Colin McEnroe, who is away. Rick Green joins us. He's assistant managing editor at the Hartford Current. Good to see you once again, Rick.
Hey, John. How are you today?
Doing quite well. And Christine Stewart is here. She's editor of ctnewsjunkie.com. Fresh back, and I probably will ask you from this, fresh back from a cross-country train trip. Last year at this time, we were talking about your travails trying to navigate across the skies of America. We'll hear a little bit about your train travel in just a little bit, but welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So today is the first day of the state legislative session, and that's where we're going to spend a lot of our time off the top. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. If you have thoughts about what the priorities should be at the state capitol this year, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at The Wheelhouse. You wrote in your piece today, Christine, on ctnewsjunkie.com, that this is an unscripted session. What do you mean? I mean, what's different about this than a normal legislative start?
Well, I guess a normal legislative start, everybody would know where they're supposed to be, where they're supposed to what their committee assignments are, what their roles are in the legislature. And at this point, we don't know. One of the caucuses has had some committee assignments announced and leadership positions announced. I felt bad for the employee who was in the House yesterday and was like, okay, who are going to be the leaders of the House? Because I need to put them up on the board where we all vote. So somebody needs to come to that conclusion pretty soon. But that hasn't happened. And we also have an election which saw, you know, the Democratic majority in the state Senate go to an even divide with Republicans. And we saw Republicans pick up 8 seats in the House, which shrunk that Democratic majority,
so,
too.
So is it about those changes, those electorally based changes, the evenly divided Senate, the movement by Republicans in the House? Is that what's causing all of this delay, or is it a little bit deeper than that?
Some of it is being caused by that. I think that both Democrats and Republicans are trying to figure out their new roles. So what are these new roles and where, you know, there's going to have to be a lot more bipartisan cooperation in this whole thing, but they haven't done this in a very long time.
This whole cooperation thing is new,
and they were able to strike the power sharing agreement after Senator Looney had his kidney transplant. So in the Senate, so those rules are taken care of. At the same time, you know, we may have some lawmakers today that don't get sworn in order to take jobs in state government.
Yes, and we'll hear some details on that. And just to be clear, Senator Looney did not have his kidney transplant in the Senate chamber,
no.
Which would be kind
yes.
of interesting. That actually didn't happen. We're going to get into some specifics in a moment, Rick. But what are you looking at? What's so different about this legislative session to you?
Well, I think what Christine was saying was is about the sort of the unscripted nature certainly is a one feature that stands out. I think for me, I don't think realistically we're going to see any of the big problems solved this session. I'm more curious about some of these outlier issues. Will they tackle Hartford's finances? How far does marijuana legislation get? What about tolls? I don't see them really enacting far-reaching budget changes or tackling the pension. So it's these sort of outlier issues that interest me.
But interestingly, though, some of those outlier issues, I mean, that we've been preoccupied with in the past, say something like Keno in the state, it becomes more of a important issue because it has even a small or unknown fiscal note attached to it, right? If we're talking about something like casinos or marijuana, the only reason it might come up now is not because of some great social movement, but because, well, we need the money wherever we can get it.
We can generate some revenue, right?
So, maybe.
Well, right, exactly. So these areas that can get some steam because they can bring in a little money, they will get some more attention, I think.
What are you seeing as we start off this session, Ben?
Well, it's interesting when you're talking about trying to raise funds to show how desperate they are. There's a proposal to increase the bottle bill, bring that whole thing back up, try to balance the budget on going around and having people collect cans is a little bit desperate. I think that one of the things that's really needs to be addressed, and the marijuana issue feeds into it, is this opiate addiction. It's a real epidemic throughout the state. It doesn't get as much press, frankly, as it should. It's devastating families. Down in southeastern Connecticut, it's really brutal. The average age of an opiate addict in southeastern Connecticut is in their early 50s. And so it really needs to be addressed. And the marijuana issue, though, and the legalization or the greater availability of marijuana can be an answer to this problem. There's a lot of medical evidence behind the fact that using medical marijuana instead of going to an opiate can be a real benefit. So.
Well, you know, since Ben brought it up, and we were going to talk about this a little bit later, but I might want to ask our other panelists about this briefly. You know, Rick Green, you spent some time in the last couple of years in the state of Vermont. We just got a report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We've been following this across New England, which I cover, over the course of the last couple of years. And it seems clear that most of the New England states have a real problem with opioid addiction and overdose, and it's getting worse. One state that's actually bent back the curve a bit is Vermont. Now, Vermont's governor some years ago devoted an entire state of the state address to the scourge of opioid addiction. Not about the budget. It wasn't about fixing other problems at the state level, but it was about saying we're going to devote ourselves to not having so many young people, middle-aged people dying from opioid addiction. Did you see a little bit of that in Vermont, and do you see Connecticut maybe thinking about taking some proactive moves to try to stop the problem here?
Well, when I was working up there for a few years, they certainly talked about it a lot.
Yeah,
it was the topic of discussion everywhere. Here, you know, I don't see the division on it here. I mean, this is something I think Republicans and Democrats can agree to come up with, whether, you know, it's more funding for treatment or whatever. So I think that's probably an area where you will see some action this time here, just because, you know, it crosses boundaries from in terms of who it affects. It doesn't hurt to have the governor talking about it a lot.
Well, and that's one of the things that has been cited,
right.
You know, Christine, is that when the governor of Vermont said we're going to actually pay a lot of attention to it, all of a sudden Vermont began paying attention to it in a way that has at least helped that state cope with a problem better than its neighbor New Hampshire, for instance, which has been very slow to move. Ben makes one point. People say if you legalize marijuana, this is a way for more people to get some sort of pain relief that gets away from very addictive opioids. On the other hand, a lot of people I've talked to at the state level say now is not the time to talk about legalization or further legalization of marijuana in the state, given the fact that many in the medical community view it as a gateway drug toward opioids.
Yeah, that's an interesting argument. And I think Malloy is somewhere in between on this argument, because obviously he believes that the opioid epidemic is an epidemic and a crisis in the state. And I think he's kind of waiting to see what happens with Massachusetts. Now, Massachusetts delayed implementation by 6 months to set up the shops that would sell what ends up being recreational marijuana, and how, you know, like liquor, like tobacco, you know, will these things cross over the border? I think Malloy feels that he's gone as far as he can go with medical marijuana and decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana in previous legislative sessions. So I don't believe that he's going to, you know, this is going to be one of his proposals. He may come around to it. I know that Senator Martin Looney has proposed legislation to legalize it and tax it.
Yeah, and just a note for our listeners, you know, north of the border, in Massachusetts, there's this ballot question. Legalization of marijuana comes to the state, but then you see in action what can happen at the state legislative level as this gets pushed back. An awful lot of people, Ben, in the state of Massachusetts, including the governor there, was not behind this particular proposal. When you talk about this issue, marijuana and the opioid epidemic, what would you want to see legislators actually do?
Well, I think what Connecticut has done has actually been a really not to sober approach, if you will. Jonathan Harris, who's the commissioner of consumer protection, has done a great job. And I think what they want to do is continue to expand the amount of disease states in which medical marijuana can be used for. I'm not for, personally, I don't think we should just open the floodgates, because I do think that that becomes somewhat irresponsible. But I do think we need to, as Rick correctly points out, build on the fact that there's a lot of people on both sides of the aisle that see that there are some real benefits to this. And for those people who it can help, and if we can work with those companies involved with trying to get people off opiate addiction, that's the benefit. But I can understand certainly why someone doesn't want to go from 0 to 60 right away, because it's not so much the gateway drug. I think it has more to do with simply being responsible. This is a medicine. You know, it needs to have a prescription and needs to be treated as such.
And I think that, you know, Connecticut has implemented medical marijuana in a way that hasn't opened the floodgates. There, last I looked, there were about 15,000 people who have medical marijuana cards in the state.
Yeah, and of course, one argument that was made at the state of Massachusetts is this will bring in tax revenue, something Connecticut could use. Of course, in Massachusetts, one of the things they're looking at and taking time to look at is the tax structure, whether or not they'll actually get the money back that they expect to get back out of this. Well, let's move on from that, because there's a lot of those issues that will come up during the state legislative session. I want to ask our panel about, well, this leadership thing. Christine was saying they didn't know until very recently who to put up there in terms of House leadership. You know, who's the House Speaker going to be? And if you're going to spell Arasimowitz, it takes a lot of letters. I mean, maybe quickly, Christine, tell us about this ethics panel clearing Joe Arasimowitz to both be the Speaker of the House and also continue in the job that he's had with a state employee union.
Yeah, so Joe Arasimowitz works as the education coordinator for AFSCME, which is one of the largest state employee unions. And so his office asked the Office of State Ethics for an opinion on whether he can hold that job. It's a part-time legislature, so most lawmakers do have other jobs. Hold that job and be Speaker of the House. And the Office of State Ethics said, yes, that's fine, because he is – and he can also vote on things that would impact the union as a whole, but not any individual member of that union. You know, so he could vote on contracts. I mean, there's been these allegations from Republicans that, you know, he can't be impartial because he's a member of a union when union contracts come up. And that's going to be a lot of the discussion this year. I don't think any of the contracts regarding salary and working conditions have made it through the arbitration process yet to get back to the legislature. But generally, I think since the 1990s, the lawmakers have decided to allow most of the contracts to go into effect without voting on them.
And if Colin McEnroe was here, Rick, he'd say, you know, the Office of State Ethics, when asked a question, are you able to continue to serve? They usually go, yeah, sure, whatever. And that's how our state ethics office often works. What do you see in this? I mean, if we're going to, as we'll talk about in a moment, take Comptroller Kevin Lembo at his word that we're being crushed by pension obligations and serious conversations with state employees need to happen. Do we need to have a Speaker of the House who holds an important position within a union?
I think it's a valid thing to bring up, but let's be honest, they all have conflicts. They all have connections. And the question to me ultimately is, are whoever is there, are they willing to make tough decisions? Are we willing to accept smaller government? Are we willing to accept a smaller payroll? You know, we can spend all our days arguing over whether the speaker is being controlled by a public employee union. Let's just see what they do. Let's see if they actually take some steps to do some things. I don't personally think the state is ready to accept drastically smaller government, even though it needs smaller government because it can't afford what it's trying to do right now.
Ben?
Well, I mean, I'm a believer in a full-time legislature, but that's another whole story. The idea that he can't be speaker because he's in a union is somewhat silly. What difference? I mean, I know speaker is a very important position, but if he's
not in a union, well, working for a union.
Working for a union, yes.
His job represents people who theoretically would be part of this conversation that we're having.
Exactly. But to me, you know, then if you follow the logic, then he shouldn't be in the legislature because he could still vote on things. So, you know, he's a fine gentleman as far as I know, and he's you know, dedicated public servant. And, you know, we have to, you know, we have this, that's why we have this part-time legislature, which, again, I think is silly in this day and age.
But. Well, it's a whole conversation that we could have, indeed, as we talk with Ben Duvall and Rick Green and Christine Stewart. Well, let's just actually get to that. If one of the biggest issues that they're going to tackle is, well, are there more conversations on the table with state employees? There's been a negotiation between Governor Malloy and state employees over pensions. We saw in the Hartford Courant, you know, Kevin Lembo, the state comptroller, wrote an op-ed talking about unfunded pension liabilities and how we are being crushed underneath them. We have to do something about that. So how does this currently constituted legislature, headed up by a new group of Democrats, certainly on the House side, how do they deal with this?
Yeah, no, it's tough because the agreement that Malloy reached with the labor unions, which lawmakers can vote on or they can allow to go into effect in 30 days, requires the state to increase the payment to the pension fund up to $2.2 million a year. And if there's only about
$2 billion.
If there's only $8 billion in discretionary funding within a $20 billion state budget, there's going to be some funding that doesn't, you know, state agencies and services aren't going to be funded.
Yes. And that's always, of course, Rick, the problem here. As we talk about all the other things we have to watch for, there's a lot that won't be funded because we have this enormous pension obligation.
Yeah. And so what are we willing to accept less of? Is it fewer drug counselors, Ben?
Right.
I don't know.
I
is
agree.
It, you know, fewer guys on the highway? You know, this is all going to happen. I mean, because as Christine just said, where are they going to get this money to plug the gap?
Right. It's not complicated.
They're not going to raise taxes.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not complicated. It's arithmetic.
Okay, so it's not
no money.
Yes, it's arithmetic, but so you say they're not going to raise taxes. I mean, we know we've sort of argued here with Governor Malloy. At a certain point, they're going to raise taxes again,
right,
despite the fact that there's been a series of tax increases over the course of the last couple of years, something that has driven down Governor Malloy's approval ratings quite substantially in the state, not to mention the legislatures as well. I don't know how they get out of this without raising some taxes.
Well, I mean, yeah. Look what they did. The governor did last week, which was as a result of what the legislature enacted last summer, the cuts to education cost sharing that largely fell on wealthy communities, that, mm-hmm, you know, they really whacked the what little money those towns get in state education money. Probably what they should be doing. Should wealthy towns be getting money from the state for schools? If you don't have much money, probably not. But people were howling about that, and I'm sure you'll see attempts to restore that money when the legislature gets going. So, you know, what kind of hard decisions are we going to be willing to make?
Yeah, and if one of them indeed is education, Ben, this is – I mean, it's one thing for rich towns to take in that burden a little bit. It's another thing for poorer cities and towns to take on that burden as well. Not to mention all the other services across the board that have to do with social services that might be cut.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, it's just getting to a point, and I think Kevin Lembo's piece was well placed, because these liabilities we have were put in place years and years and years ago by Republican and Democratic governors and legislatures, and now we're all having to pay for it. And it's just getting to the point where there really is no more money. So drastic cuts are going to have to be made in one way or another, or we just keep kicking the can down the road, which is where I think they're going to go with the gubernatorial election coming up. So everybody's going to, you know, as Rick points out, they're going to restore the money that was cut from, I think it was Darianne, got a big whack and all the rest of it. But the hard decisions never seem to be made. And unfortunately, at some point, the state will be like Hartford if we're not careful.
But if they don't do it this year, then they're not going to do it next year, because next year they're going into the yeah, gubernatorial electoral cycle.
Well,
so if
true,
they're going to make the cuts, or if they're going to have to raise the taxes they're going to have to raise, they want to do it this year. So at least we may, yeah, forget something. I don't know.
Well, and that's the point. I mean, Ben talks about math, Rick. I guess I just don't see how they cut out of this hole, because, like, let's say you make more cuts to aid to cities and towns. Well, those cities and towns have to go back and, right, figure out a way to raise that money, and that's going to be taxes at the local level, and nobody wants to see that. at a certain point, the state's going to have to raise taxes again. And I don't know if they do it now or if there's some way that we see around that, because that's what lawmakers are going to say. Governor Malloy is going to say today that he doesn't want to raise any more taxes,
well,
obviously.
It'll be your property taxes that gets raised. That's right. Sleight of hand that at work there.
Well, yes, but
it's been 6 years since, you know, there's been any sort of substantial cut to municipal aid. And so I think that's where Governor Malloy has to go, even though he's criticized New Jersey Governor Chris Christie for doing that back in 2012.
Well, I think he just reflexively criticizes Chris Christie just for waking up in the morning. But that's another conversation. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about what we expect to see at the state legislature as it gets kicked off today. Not a whole lot of fanfare as we're staring at this big budget deficit. Kind of a gloomy time in Hartford. You can join Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, Rick Green, Assistant Managing Editor of the Hartford Current, and Ben Duvall, a former Republican strategist, owner of Dromana Strategy. He's sitting in for Colin McEnroe today. We're in the wheelhouse here on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Colin McEnroe is off today, but we are joined by Ben Duvall, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, and Rick Green from the Hartford Current. It's the first day of the legislative session. Christine is heading over there to cover the start of the session in just a couple minutes. I very quickly want to ask you about your cross-country travel by train, Christine. We always talk about rail infrastructure here in our region, whether or not more high-speed rail, more reliable rail services might make transportation around here a little bit better. You haven't done this before to go home and visit family. You got stuck in all sorts of plane travel heading out to Chicago last year, so you decided to take the train. What was it like for you?
It was amazing. It was so much fun. And it was so much more relaxing than plane travel and running through an airport and trying to make connections. Yes, there are some delays, but, you know, they plan for that. I mean, you know, if you have a layover. We went from Windsor to Washington, D.C., and then D.C. to Chicago. And once we got to Chicago, we took the train then to my parents' house, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
It was relaxing. There was a dining car. We got warm food.
You guys have experience with train travel recently?
Not across country.
Yeah.
I once went all the way across Canada via
rail. That sounds good. But, that sounds fun.
But you know, we're going to get commuter rail to Hartford in a year.
In a
that's
year?
Gonna be,
is it really going to happen in a year?
That's what they're saying, 2018. That's life-changing for Hartford. Yeah,
well, it very well could be life-changing for Hartford. I mean, what are the things that make it life-changing for Hartford? I mean, obviously people are able to get up and down that 91 corridor a lot more easily, but what else?
We want to get people to the casino in Springfield, right?
There you go.
Well, I mean, not only that. I mean, you know, from Windsor to Hartford to Berlin to Meriden to Wallingford, I think that you see around the train station in Meriden has been a complete revival of that area and will improve improve the development in those areas.
Yeah, they got in on this early. They saw the need for this, and Meriden started developing.
No, I'm a huge train guy, so I mean, I take the train to D.C. My old job on a fairly regular basis. I mean, you know, twice a month or something. It was just great. It's so much easier than even driving to Providence and the plane.
But still getting more commuter rail out to your part of the world.
Yeah.
It makes a whole lot of sense. Absolutely. Eastern Connecticut, that's always been a problem.
Yep.
Let's swoop back here to the beginning of the state legislative session. We talked about a bit of the leadership. Christine, what is the substantive change that has to do with this new divide in the state Senate and this smaller advantage that the Democrats have in the House? I mean, how do you see this playing out?
So when you look at it beginning when a bill becomes a law. So if you start at that level, so the big committees, the appropriations, the finance, the transportation, education committees, where there's a lot of lawmakers on those committees, Democrats only have a 2-vote majority. So the committee process is going to narrow down and kind of funnel legislation. So more controversial legislation, maybe something more progressive legislation, something like paid family medical leave, is not ever going to get to one of the chambers. They can propose it, they can have discussions on it, but I don't believe that something like that would make it to. So we're going to have fewer bills that are going to be debated by the large group. And then Democrats are going to have to figure out how to work with Republicans, especially in the House, because, you know, if three Democrats end up, you know, switching their vote now with Representative Dargan leaving, then there would be a tie on legislation.
One of the things, Rick, we've heard from years from Republicans like Len Fasano in the Senate is he wants more Republican ideas to be able to come to the fore. A lot of times Democrats have said, well, put more ideas out there and we'll act on them. But now this actually puts a structure in place. Some of the Republican ideas will actually get a little bit more of a hearing. Do you see that making a difference at the Capitol?
I guess what I'm more interested in is what is this common ground that might develop, right? Are there moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans who, along with maybe even the unpopular governor, decide to work together as opposed to the chamber being dominated by the far left and then the disruptive sort of Republicans to the right? So, I mean, will they really make decisions in the middle, where most people are, by the way,
sure,
that we never acknowledge, and actually achieve some things?
So,
that's kind of a storyline I'm curious about.
So I also think a byproduct of this whole thing is that the debate is actually going to be better in the chambers.
Christine,
and it's going to
really
have to be better
there.
In the chambers, because you're actually, for the first time in a long time, going to have to convince your colleagues to vote for or against something.
That sounds – isn't that the way it's supposed to work? Whoa. Ben, that's really revolutionary.
It is revolutionary. There's actually going to be debate in the halls of debate. No, it's going to be really interesting because with the closeness, and I think it goes to the whole idea of why you need a vibrant two-party system, because when you don't have that, you end up having lots of bad legislation and spending too much money or too many regulations or what have you. So I think it's going to be very, very interesting this year, the debates, particularly in the House, I think.
Well, and you've said for years, Ben, I mean, you're a former Republican who's firmly in the middle. Lots of people you work with and friends of yours are Democrats. You're one of those people Rick's talking about who's right in the middle. I mean, what does the middle look like for you in terms of what you want to see this newly devised legislature doing?
Yeah. Well, I think they have to be very aggressive on the whole matter of pensions. I mean, there have to be some very difficult discussions about, as Rick points out, do you want more drug counselors or not? And you know, this goes all the way back to when Lowell Weicker put in the income tax. I know now the phones will blow up. But the fact of the matter is you've got to say, what are you for and what are you going to spend the money on? You can't just say, well, I'm for all these wonderful things, but we're not going to spend the money. And that's where we've been for too long. And we will end up like, unfortunately, the city of Hartford if the state doesn't really get control of this.
Well, we've mentioned the city of Hartford a couple times, and in the last couple of weeks, Rick, we've mentioned, you know, Luke Bronin, the mayor of Hartford, going out on kind of a magical mystery tour, going to the towns around him, saying, you know, help, not like give us money, but just understand that Hartford bears an awful lot of the brunt of the region. What do you see in that as we head into this legislative session? Is there going to be a little bit more of a look from state lawmakers saying, look, if the capital city can't survive, if it falls into bankruptcy, if it really needs to rely on the surrounding towns and we don't substantively change something, I mean, that creates a big black hole for us. I mean, what do we do about Hartford?
Well, I'm sure the mayor has a plan. I don't think he's just wandering around saying, give us more money.
We need a pro hockey team.
And yeah, let's build a hockey arena. I personally think there's not going to be more money from the state. But, you know, maybe it has to go as far as bankruptcy. Maybe you got to have a rebirth here. Maybe they got to do something. Maybe this is that moment.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree with you. You can't have a black hole in Hartford. There's a lot of promising things happening in Hartford.
There are.
About. Housing, you know, the rail coming in, UConn downtown, Front Street. I mean, there's really unusual things. But they got to do something. And I don't think they're going to do it by a little appropriation to Hartford, because it's a far-reaching thing that Hartford's dealing with.
Got the yard goats.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is that so for the first time now with Representative Matt Ritter being majority leader in the House, Hartford finally has some power in the legislature that it had not had in more than a decade.
His father was there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Well, and I think that that's a key point. One thing that makes the phones blow up, Christine, is when people who love the city of Hartford feel like what we're doing is talking down Hartford, or people saying Hartford isn't great. There are a lot of actually really interesting things happening, but the city's facing bankruptcy, and it's not the only city in the state that is struggling there. How do you expect the legislature, if not small appropriations, to actually grapple with this notion that our city centers need to be vibrant? You know, the outgoing Speaker of the House, Brendan Sharkey, was really big on regionalization in many ways. I don't know if that's a conversation that we begin to have once again, given the problems of Hartford.
Yeah, I don't think that regionalization is going to be a hot topic of discussion this year. But I think that if you simply fund payment in lieu of taxes, pilot, the state grant for property that's not taxable by a municipality—
And fully fund it,
you begin to solve, you know, some of the problems even-handedly, you know, across the board, so it doesn't look like you're giving some sort of bailout to Hartford.
But that just sort of, to me, I mean, I don't disagree with you, except that's what we've been doing. I think there needs to be a discussion on regionalization. This idea of 169 towns, it's ridiculous. It's got to go. You know, I know I'm being a heretic here, but we've got to really look at some sort of regional governments, because it's just crazy the way
what does it look like in your mind, Ben? Because, I mean, I come from a place, Pennsylvania, where county government is something mm-hmm. that's in place, and it's been in place for a long time. And you know what that looks like? Another layer of bureaucracy in government. It's another person
that.
You have to pay taxes to.
No.
Another set of people making decisions that impact your life negatively.
I totally understand what you're saying. I guess what my position is what we have now working? And my response is no. And so let's take a look at doing something different. Let's think outside the box. You know, we have these regional authorities, where the Southeastern Connecticut,
COGs.
The COGs.
The COGs,
you know, that sort of thing. I mean, you know, certainly in areas of—
Have you ever been to a COG meeting?
Yeah, I know. I was having insomnia problems. I went. I'm all good. But seriously, we can't continue in this state to do things the way we've done them. I mean, look where we're at. And so we have to start thinking outside the box. And I know when anybody picks up their head and says, I got a new idea, it is bashed, which mine will probably be. But we need to look at new ways of doing things.
But even something as simple as Brendan Sharkey's proposal to have one school calendar.
I know.
So that all the buses can be regionalized and on the same schedule, like, has gone nowhere.
Right. Well,
okay, it has gone nowhere. And there's an example,
you
Rick.
Don't
it's,
give up.
It's
you
not
don't
a
give
big
up.
It's not a big thing. It's a little tiny thing, and we can't get some of those little tiny things done. It's, do we ever move toward a big change like Ben is talking about?
I'm going to let Ben talk all day about it, because I think it's a colossal waste of time. I just don't think it's a worthy discussion.
Well, what's
I think
the
we
answer,
should focus
though?
On things that can work, that mm-hmm. can happen. We got you know, commuter rail coming in. You got, you know, more housing in Hartford. You got to figure out, I don't know, is it a sales tax or is it bankruptcy? But hey, I live in West Hartford. I chose that because of my kids going to schools there. Lots of people make that decision. I don't think we're going to have government coming in and telling people they can't make that choice.
And as you want to loop back to the payment in lieu of taxes thing, Christine, it is sort of the way we've been doing things for a while. I'll go to a city in Ben's neck of the woods, New London. If you think Hartford is small and plagued by untaxable land, New London's even worse, right? It's this tiny little postage stamp and has all these problems. You can fund it in lieu of taxes out the wazoo, and it doesn't solve the underlying problem of a, what is it, 10 square mile or 7 square mile city that actually has to bear the responsibility for all sorts of, you know, stuff that cities do.
Right, which goes back then to legislative clout, too, because I believe that, you know, New Haven over these past few years has been, you know, they've had the leadership positions, the lawmakers there, and I think that New Haven has not been hurt as badly as some of these other cities, because there's been formulas and they've been able to sneak funding here and there, and that's what happens.
And I want to be clear, I'm not suggesting for a minute that regionalization or county government is an answer. To Rick's point, I agree. If something's working, I'm a big believer, whatever's working, let's do more of it. But there's no way anybody can say that currently our state is working well with the budget problems we have, with the reduced population leaving, the difficulty in keeping jobs here.
Yeah, but
we need a fundamental change.
The whole,
we need to at least talk about it.
I think I'm I'm just tired of hearing about everybody loves to talk about how much it sucks here in Connecticut.
No, I don't think it does.
You know,
everybody's
moving out. I think we got to focus on things that work, and that can be not.
But you wouldn't,
can be bipartisan,
right? But you wouldn't disagree that we've got some really huge systemic problems in the state that need to be addressed,
yeah.
And they're not going to be addressed by doing the same thing we've done for 25 and 30 years.
Yeah, I agree.
Let's talk about something that works. I mean, pick out something. What's something that the state, the governor, the legislature, as they start off, municipal leaders as they go up to the Capitol and they ask for help. I mean, what's something you think that works? That I mean, you mentioned commuter rail. What else?
We have good public schools here. Don't let people tell you that we don't have good public schools, despite what that judge said. We have excellent public schools here. We have areas where there's extreme poverty. That's a problem. Poverty is a problem, but public education is not the problem here. We have great promise in certain areas of manufacturing and industry here, whether it's aerospace or, in the Connecticut Valley, medical instruments and all that sort of thing. I mean, I think we have to look at what works here and focus on that.
I couldn't agree more. And that's one of the things that I don't think we do a very good job of, frankly, is talking about this is working over here, so why isn't it working over here? You know, that's my point.
Yeah.
But some of the larger structural issues of the state are, I think, impeding us from really bursting out. I mean, Connecticut should be – I mean, it's got such an educated workforce. It's in a great location. I mean, I can talk about it all day. I mean, I live down there in Stonington, which we refer to as fantasy land. This whole state has got a lot to offer, but there are some deep structural issues that have to be addressed.
Christine, before you have to go, I just want to ask you a very little bit of minutia that's actually could be a little important. You reported this week on Representative Stephen Dargan making a really hard decision to actually not take his job once again today.
Nice.
So what's happening?
So he is not running. He resigned yesterday in a letter to the Secretary of State and is not taking the oath. And he is going to take a job with the Board of Pardons and Paroles. So after 26 years and 20 of those years being chairman of the Public Safety Committee.
And what that means substantively is that lead, for at least for now, that the Democrats have in the House chamber gets just a little smaller, which makes it, again, a little bit of a difficult decision right now.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a difficult decision. I think that the decision on, he was very torn about this decision. And, he knows that his critics are going to say it was, an effort to spike his pension, in the last few years. But he really does love public service. And I don't know what we're going to do without his comic relief.
Maybe we'll save the whole critics say it will spike his pension conversation for another day here in the wheelhouse, because that could take us an hour. Christine Stewart's got to run to the state capitol to cover the beginning of the legislature. Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. Thanks so much, Christine.
Thanks, John.
When we come back, we'll take a few more of your phone calls here, get you involved in the conversation at 860-275-7266 with Rick Green from the Hartford Current, Ben Duvall from Germana Strategies here in the wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Ben Duvall. He's a former Republican strategist who owns Dromana Strategies. Rick Green is assistant managing editor at the Hartford Current. Colin McEnroe is off today, but in his place at 1 o'clock this afternoon, we'll be re-listening to a really fascinating conversation he had last year with former NBA star and Connecticut native Vin Baker, whose fortunes rose and then fell, and now he's in a new place in his life. And it's a really interesting, wide-ranging conversation with someone who a lot of people know through the world of sports, but you get to know a lot more about him. I hope you can listen to today's Colin McEnroe show. Let's go to the phones. Peter is calling from Stamford. Hi there, Peter. Well, let's see if we can actually click Peter on. I don't know if that's going to work. If somebody can put Peter's phone line on, we can talk to him. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Happy New Year.
Hi. Happy New Year to you as well.
Hello. Unfortunately, I don't have too many suggestions, answers. I know a lot of problems we have. And, one of the famous quotes of John McCain and Barack Obama was when 8 years ago was, the fundamentals of the economy are strong. The fundamentals of the economy remain strong. And I don't know if that's really true anymore for Connecticut or for the nation or for the world. It's really a global problem. I think Connecticut is a microcosm of this huge problem. We have just not enough income. I mean, I think we could all solve this problem by having 1,000 Powerball winners in Connecticut, 1,000 lottery winners in Connecticut, and then we'd have the income stream we need.
Yeah.
we don't have a big employer anymore. We don't have the brass works. We don't. I guess we have some medical. We have some aerospace. We have some science. But there's no big employers anymore. There's no big income stream anymore.
Peter, I will say, I mean, we still do have some big employers, and we have maintained some of those. One of the things you're talking about, though, is the income stream from people paying taxes. That's probably the opposite, though, of the fundamentals of the economy. I mean, one of the issues we've had is the question of what does the economy consist of, right? Is it a bunch of people pushing money around in Wall Street? We saw how that worked back in 2008. I mean, what do the fundamentals of a Connecticut economy look like? Is it just more big manufacturers coming back? I don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, more people working, more people contributing to property taxes. You know, how fair our property tax system is. More people, which helps the towns. More people contributing to our income tax. More people, contributing to the taxes of the services we need. And
sure.
there's more people now that are actually receiving these much needed services, which is valid. They need them. I'm a counselor in a group home, and we certainly have a need for that.
Peter, I hear what you're saying. Let me get to Rick Green and Ben to maybe make some suggestions around this. So, I mean, Peter's talking about bringing jobs back, more income to pay taxes. Obviously, yeah, those are all some of the things that we need. But he also says, Ricky works in a group home. They're going to need some help from the state, too.
Yeah, and let's not lose sight of the fact that we're losing population and that's one of the fundamental forces that's changing the state. But, you know, I think the business community, the industrial leaders, they realize the problem is revitalizing the cities. They're not going to attract a young, educated workforce unless we have cities that work. And you're hearing that all over the state now, whether that's New Haven, Bridgeport, or Hartford. And there's got to be more discussion about how we create urban centers that will attract young people, because, you know, as everybody said, GE didn't leave because of the taxes here as much as you heard about all that. It's because they went to a cool city where there were lots of highly educated, affluent young people, and there were things happening. And we've got to create that on some level here in Connecticut. I mean, we can't be, you know, Boston or anything, but we can be something here in Hartford.
Yeah, in the region. And, you know, Rick talks about how we're aging. You know, I cover New England states. The six New England states are six of the oldest places.
Scary.
It's incredibly scary.
One big nursing home.
We're the six least fertile states. We have the fewest children. And one thing that a lot of people are looking at, that my New England News Collaborative has been looking at, is immigration. Right. I mean, if we didn't have people coming into the state from outside, we don't have anybody.
Yeah, well, it was actually a very interesting article recently about a family from Syria up in Vermont being pulled together. It was really touching, actually. One thing I should say, though, is down in my area, Electric Boat, I mean, if you just walk down the street, they're going to hire you. I mean, they are building submarines. I think they just put one out this morning. I mean, you know, Joe Courtney and all, and EB has not been this busy since my father worked there in the 80s, and that's not just EB, that spreads out. And I think to Rick's point also, the gentleman who called in said we don't have a lot. We have a lot of small to medium-sized medical device companies and all starting up in Connecticut, and they need to be more touted and talked about, because that's where the growth is going to be. We're not going to have giant manufacturing companies, but we're going to have a lot of high tech.
And a lot of the manufacturing stream for those bigger companies are here as well, very small mom and pops. I mean, and I know you wanted to say something too about this immigration question, Rick. I mean, this is a really big point. The only replacement that we have for the aging population, and in some cases the only people taking care of that aging population, are people from elsewhere.
And in 20 years, what do you get? You get a smaller, younger population supporting a much larger and needier old population. And, you know, if you look at our recent history in Connecticut, it's you're right. It's the immigrants population coming here, working, holding jobs, starting families. That's what's kept us, propped us up. We're losing that now. And I think it's very scary.
Well, one of the things that Governor Malloy has, he's battled a little bit with some other states over questions of welcoming in Syrian refugees, welcoming in people from elsewhere in the world. It's one of the things that I think not just locally but nationally Malloy is universally praised in some circles for. But we've said this a couple times already. Here's a guy with a very low approval rating, someone who we expected might go serve in a Hillary Clinton cabinet. Well, we knew that that didn't happen. So what about Governor Malloy? Yeah. Is he through a talks today to the legislature?
Yeah, he doesn't make it easy. I think that's the problem. Well, but do the dire problems this legislature faces, does that present an opening for Malloy to carve out some sort of solution with moderate Republicans and Democrats and raise his political fortunes? Most people would say no, but I think it's – I'm fascinated with it. I'd like to – I don't see much opposition out there. I don't see many terribly impressive potential gubernatorial candidates here.
Do we see a kind of a – a Governor Malloy resurgence as he tries to tackle with the legislature, this new type of legislature, all these problems?
Well, I always think that when things are, as McCain used to say, Chairman Mao, it's always darkest before it's totally black. And that's sort of right where Malloy is now. And so I think yes. I think that, you know, where does he have to go, right? I mean, he's pretty far down. And to Rick's point, the legislature is going to have to make some very difficult decisions, and he's going to be the one who's going to be the recipient of those decisions, positive or negative. If they're negative, so what? He's already down. If they're positive, he can build on that.
You talked about the submarines that are built down in your area. I know you want to talk about one thing that actually has an impact in your world. Increased fishing regulations on the fishing fleet in Stonington. Yep. Obviously, this is something that's watched very closely in some parts of New England, more so than others. But this is a big issue. We've got climate change affecting the ability for fishermen to make a living. We have a brand new EPA coming in. What do you see in this, Ben?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. It's a multifaceted challenge. I have a very good friend of mine who works for DEEP, and the increase in the temperature in Long Island Sound is dramatic. The change of the fish population. The fishermen in Stonington are really worried that they're going to totally be shut out. I think the regulations are – it's very complicated. I don't pretend to know about it. I just know that I love my local guys and the local fishermen, and there needs to be some help there. But it's going to be very interesting to see how this Trump – EPA deals with our DEEP.
But so this is – and this is interesting. This is one of the issues that we have, and I think a lot of people are saying right now, Donald Trump hasn't taken office, so we don't exactly know what he's going to do. He says an awful lot of things. But here's one, Rick, where you could imagine an EPA coming in that says we want less regulations. You could say that we have an administration coming in that says we want fewer fishing regulations. We want people to be able to go and make money at sea. But if they're also saying, well, climate change doesn't really exist and we're not going to battle this problem that keeps fish from actually being in the waters, how exactly does that play out?
Well, if you know, California is trying to stake out this sort of almost independent republic sort of mentality. And there's some people have said, can Connecticut do that in the East? Do we sort of become this bulwark of things that we believe in supposedly here, and you know, environmental, good environment, you know, dealing with climate change, Long Island Sound? Do we provide this sort of island of blue, or island of the middle, in the face of Trump and Washington? And I don't know if Connecticut's big enough. California can, because of its size.
I want to turn to one last story here, and I'm going to hear a little bit of tape here. This is Randy Edsall. We didn't get a chance to cover this. He's the brand new football coach of UConn, and of course, the former football coach of UConn. Here he is accepting the job.
Everybody makes a mistake. I regret it. It's something that has weighed on me very heavily over the years. And I just hope that I will be able to earn the trust back from all you wonderful fans, because what I'm doing now is I apologize for how I left. It was wrong. I take full ownership and accountability for that.
Yeah, and what he's talking about here, Ben, is when he left UConn, he essentially left the team after a bowl game, didn't even say goodbye to them, and took this job at Maryland, which he said was his dream job. Now, a couple of years later, and a couple losing seasons at Maryland later, he lost his job. The state fires Bob Diaco. He's not the coach of UConn anymore. We gave him a whole bunch of money to leave, and now we're welcoming Randy Edsall back. Are we excited?
Well, I mean, I've always felt this whole football thing was a little bit too far. But I understand it's part of the whole.
You mean the sport of football, or
UConn football? I love football. Don't get me wrong, but I have to say it was very nice to see somebody in a leadership position, you know, come right out and say, you know, I'm sorry, I take full responsibility, I'm going to have to earn your trust back.
Last 30 seconds, Rick.
Yeah, I was pretty skeptical, but I was impressed by his performance when he came back here. He didn't have another choice, I guess. He had to fall on his sword, but I wish him the best. I hope he succeeds.
I would like to have an entire conversation at some point about whether or not UConn should be playing Division I football.
Agreed.
But that's a different conversation for a little bit more time with Rick Green at the Hartford Current. Thanks, Rick, for coming by.
Thanks for inviting
me. Thanks also to Ben Duvall, and thank you for listening to The Wheelhouse, produced by Katie Talarski. Thanks to Kion Wolf today. I'm John Dankowski.